This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil, now streaming, only on Hulu.
Hello, as we didn't make it to the cinema this week, we thought we'd share an episode from our Patreon where we talk about retro movies and also lots of TV. And this week we chatted about the first three episodes of True Detective Season 4. Enjoy!
What do you want from me? Why don't you run from me? What are you wondering? What do you know?
Okay, hi patrons, it's us. And we are here to talk about True Detective Night Country, season 4 of True Detective. We're going to talk about episodes 1 to 3, which have aired at the time of recording here. And this is a spoiler special. It's full spoilers. But if you are here and you haven't seen the show, I think go watch it. I think we'd both highly recommend
it. Yeah, go watch it.
It's a good watch. It's a good detective show. It's got good supernatural elements. Jodie Foster's fantastic. It's got great character moments and good writing, and it's looks grim and cool, and it's set in Alaska at nighttime, and it's just go check it out. I think if you like any of the sound of those things, go watch it.
And upfront apologies for the very breezy wind you may be hearing.
It is very windy. Now let's get into it. Okay, so full spoilers for the first three episodes,
and we think there's only six episodes, which is why we're doing three together now, and then we're gonna go do the next three together at the end.
That's right. So let's talk about the plot. So I think a very intriguing setup here. Eight scientists go missing in a sort of The Thing sort of situation. And shout out to patron Joe Kiley, who pointed out that there is a DVD of The Thing on the bookshelf next to the Ferris Bueller TV. And I thought the opening here was very, very good. Very evocative.
I loved it.
I love the set. I love the set of the scientists' place. It's very kind of sleek and modern and interesting, and it's a great setup. And then that whole, you know, there's the little tease of she's here, and then that sort of convulsion that one guy has.
Yeah, that was brilliant. It's like kind of mildly horrorish, but without being too scary.
I would say it's very horror, very much so. I think. Think of the first end of the first episode when they discover those bodies in this frozen in terror. That's not that scary,
which I appreciate.
I think it's chilling, both literally and metaphorically.
Yeah.
So I think it's a fantastic setup. The show's got good sort of cliffhangers. You know, at the end of the first episode, the bodies are discovered. End of the second episode, we discover that one of them is still out there on the run.
Yeah, that was brilliant. That was brilliant.
And then they don't really progress that too much.
And then we kind of discover via the vet in episode three that, well, he reckons they actually, they died of terror before they froze.
So good.
Where the working theory of the police had been that they froze to death, he's like, that's not what you look like if you freeze to death. That's almost like a nice death, which I do think for a bunch of detectives working in Alaska, they should probably know the difference between someone who's frozen to death and someone who's clearly experienced some sort of horrific terrorizing event.
I
was surprised that someone in the police force didn't have that knowledge.
Yeah.
But I enjoyed that a vet came in to deliver the news, and I think that's what's so interesting about this setup. Is that like Alaska's a fascinating setting because logistically it's a nightmare, right? And this is Alaska when it's all nighttime, there's no sunlight.
It's a small town
there's
in Alaska.
There's no storms,
as well, right?
They can't get like access to proper coroners, they don't have access to a proper place to thaw the bodies out, so they have to use like
an ice rink. Yeah, it's a satellite town, isn't it?
Yeah.
And I mean, like any good local detective thing, you've got that sort of tug and pull between, you know, the big town trying to take over the case and Jodie Foster's local sheriff who just wants to keep it, and she's got an axe to grind with Christopher Eccleston, her former boss slash lover,
which
I love that the show just like keeps piling on sort of almost soap opera level sort of character complications, but handles it with a sort of a real deftness.
But the thing is, you have Jodie Foster, so automatically it's prestige. Yeah. And then you've got this unbelievable cast around her as well. So at no point does it feel so poppery, albeit like some of those elements like 100% are. But I think the core setting of being in this really impenetrable town in Alaska with all this stuff going on with like the big bad like mining guys.
Oh, there's so much going on.
Who employ 50% of the village versus people who are protesting against it. I think that whole background, you've got the indigenous community versus like the white people. It's such a ripe setting. And then that's just like kind of escalating as we go on to become more of the plot, but at the beginning it's kind of just like the background to the plot.
And you've got police corruption with John Hawke's character, you know, potentially withholding information pertinent to an investigation to protect the miners and to protect the town.
And I think that, you know, piece of like the, when we kind of realise, and we realise fairly quickly that the new murderers or whatever they are kind of running parallel with like their old
A cold case investigation. Yeah, whereby, Annie Kay.
And whereby that's when Jodie Foster and who the person who's now her basically co-detective on this case fell out and haven't like worked together since that case because of how it all fell apart.
Navarro. Yeah, so I love that. We've got this, you know, you've got this little history between our two lead characters, between Navarro and Danvers, you know, an uneasy alliance. I think there's so much, the show is so like ripe with conflict, which I love, because Jodie Foster's character is basically has conflict with everybody.
I love that.
She hates everyone in the town. They hate her. She's also
She's awful to her stepdaughter. She's like, she seems racist towards the indigenous people.
Yes.
And then she's like extremely angry when her stepdaughter, who is indigenous, tries to like embrace her own culture.
Yeah.
And it's really difficult to figure out if, oh, first of all, I do think she is racist. And then secondly, I think her motive of trying to like scrub the markings off her stepdaughter's face and stuff is, I think partially that's motivated by fear, because she knows that like the evil miners and the white people are like discriminatory towards native people, maybe. But then she herself seems really racist, so that's incredibly complex. And then there's flashbacks, and at one point the stepdaughter tries to talk about something and Jodie Foster cuts her off. And I think Jodie Foster, when she was married to her dad, I think they had a little boy
they
together.
They did. There's implications of a tragedy
maybe?
Between the father and the little boy. Yeah,
yeah, because she has kind of flashbacks. You've all that going on. It like barely touched on. Now, I think the daughter kind of came quite prominent in like episode 3. So I think that the stepdaughter is going to be,
well, she's going to become
escalatingly
embroiled
part of the plot.
In the protests. Yeah. And then you've got Navarro's plots. All relate to her sister and her mother and a sort of a history of family mental health issues and then her relationship, which is probably the source of, you know, the show's few and far between comic relief, but her sort of, you know, slightly comical relationship with the local he's like, he owns a cafe and
he brews like booze.
He's a great character, and I love his sort of testy relationship with Navarro, that she's sort of, you know, using him. I love this. So we should say the show is written and directed, all 6 episodes, by Mexican director Isa Lopez, who I think has done a fantastic job here.
And she's like a literary writer. She's won heaps of awards, and she's co-written and directed every episode of this.
And I love that she's deliberately put female characters in very traditional male roles. And I don't just mean in, as you know, the sheriff and law enforcement. But, you know, the relationship Navarro has with that guy whose character name I don't know. Mm-hmm. But, you know, that smacks of a very sort of traditional male archetype of just coming in and sort of, you know, using somebody for sex whenever they want to. So she's playing with that, I think, really, really effectively. And then, you know,
but then their relationship is moments of sweetness, because then she tells him about her mother and like her childhood.
Yes.
But it's kind of done in a way, he's like, tell me something about yourself, and she's like, fuck you, and she walks off.
It's very transactional.
She's so angry when he asks her, and then she comes back and tells him.
So I think she's also, I mean, we spoke about Jodie Foster, who's naturally going to be fantastic, but Callie Reese is the actress playing Navarro. I think she's good.
She's brilliant.
I think she's just
before.
Like, she's just a real, like, when she's on screen, she's this bristling with anger and sort of, it's this pent up sort of frustration and rage. You just feel like she could explode at any minute.
But I also think that she's a really tender character when you see her with her sister.
Yes.
And in the dedication she puts to like looking after, trying to look after the local women, and particularly the cases that she's been, that case that she's been hanging on to for 5 years, because she really wants to figure out who killed this woman.
Yeah.
And then the other, and I love how they kind of told it through a flashback, whereby it was like a different case that her and Jodie Foster worked on, where there was this man who was like beating up his girlfriend and escalated to when he murdered her. And then Jodie Foster and your one, I think, killed him together.
Well, they, you know, we get the unreliable narrator here. So Danvers is telling her sort of protege, Hank Pryor's son, who's also very enjoyable, I think, as a sport character, and has his own stuff going on with his family. I mean, everyone gets fleshed out. But she's telling him the story of, yes, this final case that her and Navarro worked on. But she says he was dead when we arrived, and we see in the flashback that he was not. Tantalizing.
Love it. I think that they both pull the trigger at the same time. It's going to be something.
I think
that.
So too.
They're never telling anyone what they did.
And but I think this is also a nice little callback to the origins of True Detective in season one, which was you might remember the sort of framing for the show was, you know, it was all told through a flashback in a series of police interviews with Matthew McConaughey and Woody Harrelson at later, and you also got this unreliable narrator thing where they were telling the police one thing and we were seeing another. Now we should talk about the relationship between season one and season four. So there are a lot of links that people have spotted, I think, this season. And by the way, we haven't seen season three and we turned off season two. So I can't speak to any of the crossover there.
Season two, but we just watched one episode and we were like, absolutely not.
I think I got to two episodes. I was like, no.
Season three, I have heard actually is really good, but we just haven't had
a chance.
This is just, we've come back for this one because it's like a new creator and it just felt like a breath of fresh air. But I have heard that season three is good, so we should go back and watch it.
But season four is apparently referencing season one a lot. Now, I don't remember season one that well. I thought the plot was the least interesting part of that show. The spiral tattoo that is kind of a key plot point on Annie Kay and on the missing scientist. Features in season one quite heavily, I think. The family from season one that was sort of the cult family, I think, are referenced here. And then crucially, one main link that people spotted is that Fiona Shaw, who is barely in it so far, and I expect will play a bigger role, her sort of mystery dead lover in the wilderness who guides her towards the bodies.
Love that.
He is apparently, people suspect, is Rusty Cole's father. So Matthew McConaughey's character in season one references that they lived in Alaska and that he had a relationship.
This is set in present day, though.
So was True Detective season one.
So how could he be Matthew McConaughey's father?
Because he's much older than Matthew McConaughey, I guess.
I guess maybe he died a long time ago in this show.
I don't know.
But he looks quite young.
He could
young
be 20 years older than Matthew McConaughey in real life.
I guess. And he could have died a long time ago in this show. That we don't know.
I don't think he died that long ago. Why? He didn't say that his father was dead in season one. I don't believe.
Anyway,
he's got the same name. So it probably is him. It's something Cole.
But anyway, we need to talk about that the creator of the first season, three seasons has thrown unsolicited and unwarranted shade onto this season.
Yeah, so shout out to patron Dave O'Neill who put us onto this in the comments. But so Nick, I'm going to butcher his name, Poliziato is the original creator of True Detective, is listed as an executive producer on this season, but is not involved. This is very much Issa Rae's project.
Just basically means he probably got a kickback.
Yes, so what happened is people on the X, the platform formerly known as Twitter, RIP, people have been, fans, you know, naturally, have been like shitposting about this season. Some people aren't happy about it.
I think some of the fans are outraged that there's female leads.
Probably. I mean, there could be a bit of that wrapped up. I'm sure people have some legitimate reasons, but I'm sure there's also misogyny on X.
Yeah, I think so.
And, what's happened is he has been replying to a lot of those people, fueling the fire, saying, well, don't blame me. I've had nothing to do with this. And specifically in reference to somebody pointing out a call back to that family who has a link to this place in Alaska from season one. He wrote back something very rude, like, haha, so stupid. I can't believe they wrote something like that. I'm paraphrasing.
What is he doing? Why would you write mean things on X?
Now, Issa Lopez, has responded. Why would you write mean things on X? Wow, that's the whole fundamental basis of X now.
As an actual legitimate person in the public eye and not like a boss.
I'm sorry, we should say he has every right to not like the show.
He could just say, for reference, I've had nothing to do with this show and I know nothing about a link.
Yeah.
That's how you could throw some extremely light shade in a polite way.
The other shade he said was somebody asked, you know, somebody said, I hope Matthew McConaughey doesn't show up in this because they weren't happy with the season. And then he goes, Matthew wouldn't touch this.
Oh, yeah. That's when it's
which
like,
is like, come on, man. Like, yeah. Get over yourself.
Yeah.
Now, two things.
You very successfully created 3 seasons of a TV show. You're now executive on season 4. You've nothing to do with it. Like, just be the bigger
shut
man.
Shut up.
Well, I wouldn't say shut up, but I would say he probably pitched a season 4 that they didn't like, and he's probably salty. That's my theory.
Well, who knows? So we should say a couple of things. Firstly, he has every right to... I totally understand it's a justifiable position to be very protective of some work that you've created, mm-hmm. and it's difficult to hand it over to someone else. So that's, I think, totally reasonable reaction to have. And it's okay to not like something, but I think it is just very poor form and unprofessional to be publicly bad-mouthing something and taking some sort of position of superiority, and it's incredibly unprofessional. So I think it's incredibly inappropriate, and he comes off very badly.
I think she's done such a brilliant job of Issa Lopez.
Well, exactly.
Of bringing it life into... bringing life into the show, creating, like, one of the reasons we're so interested in it, as we mentioned, all the characters with such incredible backstories, not that much has actually happened in terms of progressing the plot, and often in particularly something that's like a detective or a mystery, I would find that like frustrating when I would be like, nothing's actually happened with the plot. But in this show I don't mind, because there's so much going on, there's so much background, there's so much interesting characters, the area is so interesting. So I think actually it's quite phenomenal what she's managed to achieve. But then the best part about all this online spat is her response to him.
Yeah, so she just took the absolute high ground. Fair play to her. I actually have her comments here. I can read them out. So
I think she just basically said he's entitled to his opinion.
Should have this ready.
Yeah, sorry. You had them and you've lost them. So.
Here we go. She said, I wrote this with profound love for the work he made and love for the people that loved it. And it is a reinvention and it is different. And it's done with the idea of sitting down around the fire and let's have some fun and have some feelings and have some thoughts. And anybody that wants to join is welcome. She also said, I mean...
Just so classy.
So classy. Fair play. What did she say? She says, I believe that every storyteller has a very specific, peculiar and unique relation to the stories they create, and whatever his reactions are, he's entitled to them. That's his prerogative.
Love her. I actually love her even more.
You can't have a classier response. And also, like, you can't, dude, don't be like firing shots off if you wrote season 2 of True Detective either. I mean, like, come on. Anyway, what else is to be said about
so John Hawkes,
the show?
Not really in it so far, but so far is the sort of bad guy who is working on behalf of
the... I don't think he's a bad guy. He's a bit of an...
Well, it's emerging that
he's an antagonist for Danvers.
No, it's emerging that he hit up important information about a murder investigation.
He has done very bad things.
That is bad.
Yes, I agree.
And I think the kind of impression we're getting, albeit hasn't explicitly been said, is that Jodie Foster probably came in above him when he thought he was going to get a promotion, because he's very snarky. He's also hiding old case files in his house. Like, it's pretty dodge. And then he smacks his kid across the face. Like, it was so interesting that... Like, their dynamic is so fascinating to watch. You know that whole, like, show don't tell? Because, Jodie Foster sends his son in to steal files from him. That's such a fascinating thing. Instead of her just saying, I'm the police chief, bring me the files. Because she knew he wouldn't.
Yeah.
So the son has to go in and steal them. The son's character, we were laughing, because the son is kind of just... Jodie Foster rings him all night for no reason. Like, at one point she was ringing him at 4 a.m. and we knew as viewers she had no reason to be ringing him. She just wants him working all the time. And he goes to her, stop trying to Mrs. Robinson, my son. And I said to Dave, that character won't know who Mrs. Robinson is. And indeed, he said, who's Mrs. Robinson?
which is great. The show actually is quite witty as well.
Witty,
it's got good moments of levity. And also, I think the other thing to credit it with is a lot of the things that happen are real tropes. They're just classic tropes. Like John Hawkes' character in The Wrong Hands is just a sort of resentful guy with his nose out of whack. But they humanize him just enough with the Russian bride that is going to end in disaster.
He's been catfished.
So it makes him a little bit pitiful.
He's been catfished.
But she also likes, even Navarro's character of this, like, you know, just like can't let that case go, and, you know, just like is like that's another like classic detective trope, which again is, I think, just in the wrong hands would come across as cliched or too tropey. So I
mean,
think
she
Issa Lopez is...
She basically got sacked out of being a cop to being like a ranger or whatever because yeah. she was like harassing senior government officials about this case. So I love for her that she's able to reinvestigate it again. And it is also really scary that like this indigenous woman is just beaten to death and like nothing happened about it and everyone covered it up.
Yeah.
And I think that's the really the kind of other like the total underlying plot of this whole thing is like what, you know, white capitalism will do to an indigenous culture. There's just so much going on. Only 3 episodes have happened. I can't wait for the next 3 episodes and we will be back here to discuss them. And I don't even have theories on it, to be honest. I have no theories on it. I'm just enjoying it unfolding. It's not that kind of murder mystery.
I don't think we have enough to work with.
We don't. No. We're just kind of enjoying watching the clues unfold and seeing where we end up, I think.
Yeah. I hope it has a satisfying ending because season one of True Detective was not very tidy, but also I think like so often an untidy ending is kind of intriguing, but I don't know.
Me,
I remember walking away from that feeling like, oh, okay.
I enjoyed the journey. I think the satisfying element for me would be actually clearing up the original murder of the woman. I'm less interested maybe in the whatever
the
terror things happen to the scientists. Yeah, yeah. I want the woman's murder solved. Yeah. Right, we'll be back in a couple of weeks to discuss the finale.
Okay, see you soon. Thanks. Oh wait, I have a theory.
What?
I have a theory. I just because I was she's coming was think something that was mentioned. I feel like it's the potentially the spirit of Annie Kay who is having her revenge.
Because
yeah,
we haven't really
guys.
Mentioned it's been quite mythical. But the freaky thing is her ex-boyfriend, whatever he was involved with her murder or not, he kept her tongue for 6 years. Like, that's disgusting.
Well, we don't know that he did that.
Well, somebody
but her
did
tongue
it.
Is there.
That
yeah.
is disgusting.
I mean, that's weird.
Yeah. The mystical stuff is fascinating as well. Like, even that we mentioned, like, casually, there's a ghost in it and stuff. So a lot of it might be hallucinations. I don't know.
The ghost of Matthew McConaughey's dad.
Yeah.
Who
anyway.
You refuse to believe could be his dad.
I just don't think that the maths ain't mathing. Anyway, bye.
Okay. Bye.
Why aren't you scared of me? Why do you care for me? When we all fall asleep, where do we go?